A strong-willed and divisive figure in British and international politics, Margaret Thatcher was the longest-serving British prime minister in the 20th century and the first woman to hold the office. She oversaw Britain's biggest social and political revolution in its post-war history. Jonathan Aiken, cabinet minister under Thatcher and a close family friend of 40 years, has a unique vantage point and brings new light to many crucial episodes of the Thatcher era. He writes about it in his new book, Margaret Thatcher, Power and Personality. I spoke with Jonathan Aiken about the source of the boundless ambition and what gave root to her astonishing force of personality.
But perhaps what hasn't been fully portrayed before my book is her personality in all its complexities. She's sometimes seen on both sides of the Atlantic as a rather one-dimensional person, a lady of tremendous strength, the Iron Lady, as the Soviets called her. And yet, that's not by any means the full picture. She was a complex personality. It will surprise perhaps some of your listeners to know that insecurity was a big part of her makeup, which she concealed from the world by perhaps overcompensating in her rather authoritarian style and in her huge attention to detail, which allowed her to dominate so many discussions, not least with Ronald Reagan and other members of his administration. So she was not an easy person, but she was a very remarkable person, and remarkability enabled her to change both Britain and the world in all sorts of very important ways.
When did you first come to know her? How did your relationship begin?
Well, it first began way back in 1966, getting on for 50 years ago, when I was the youngest parliamentary candidate for the Conservative Party in Britain in a general election. And she was a middle-ranking and still unknown, but much more senior than me, Conservative Party spokesman for land and housing. And she was on a sort of whistle-stop tour of districts which might be won by the Conservatives. And she came through to mine and spoke in the High Street. And it wasn't a tremendously memorable encounter, but if you're a 22-year-old candidate, you don't forget people who come and support you in the earliest days. And I remember her saying to me, I was the youngest Conservative candidate in the 1955 election, and you learn a lot quickly, don't you, even when you're making mistakes. And I agreed with that judgment. And then a little bit later on, I get into the House of Commons. I'm still pretty young. And she becomes leader of the opposition, but a year after I've arrived. And I'm not one of her initial supporters. I still backed the former Prime Minister, Edward Heath. But still, when she became leader of the opposition, I, of course, was loyal to her. And in a particular way, I got to know her well because I was a young bachelor in those days. And I dated her very attractive daughter, Carol Thatcher, for 3 years. This was a wonderful romantic adventure, but it wasn't what you call a good career move because the romance ended in ways which did not make Margaret Thatcher happy. And so for a time I was cast into outer darkness of disapproval, but then came back into favor again.
You write in the book that it was a relationship that you take responsibility for it. You say that the relationship ended badly and you paid that price. But I assume through that process you see another side of her.
I certainly did. I saw her in her family setting, which, whatever the outside world thought, I think anyone who was fairly close to the Thatchers did realize they were, in one sense, a pretty dysfunctional family. They didn't get on too well. There was a lot of quarreling. On the other hand, Dennis was something of a rock who managed his wife's moods and temperamental flashes with considerable skill. And he once advised me, he said, you know, when she's giving you a right royal bollocking, you just have to let it flow over until the lava stops. But I liked the Thatchers. They were an attractive family. They were not a cohesive family, particularly. And I sometimes remember rather vividly the first time I was ever asked to lunch. And it wasn't an enormous success, largely because Margaret Thatcher was trying to be very proud of the fact she just made a visit to the Middle East. And everyone knew her knowledge of the area was not very great. And she'd got on her wall an enormous great piece of golden calligraphy, which had been presented to her by late President Assad of Syria. And I was supposed to know something about the Middle East, and in particular, she knew that I spoke a bit of Arabic. And she said to me, pointing to this calligraphy, "I don't suppose your Arabic's good enough to translate that, is it?" And it was actually the easiest piece of Arabic to translate imaginable, because it was almost the most famous saying in the entire Muslim world, because the word said, "There is only one God, and his name is Allah." This was a somewhat surprising inscription to find on the lead of on the wall of a conservative opposition leader. And Margaret Thatcher sort of almost choked up with embarrassment. And Dennis said, rather amusingly, I said, "Oh, well, thank goodness we didn't have the local church minister to lunch as well." That was just an amusing moment. But it did also reveal something of the fact that she, in the early days, she had a very unsure touch in foreign affairs, something which, of course, changed.
You talk about that unsure touch, but as the subtitle of the book, as I mentioned, is Power and Personality, and you write a lot about her unique capacity to exercise power. That seemed like something that she possessed from the very beginning. She seemed very comfortable in her own skin and very willing to exercise that power.
I'm not sure she was totally comfortable in her own skin at the beginning, because she had a lot of opponents within her own party who made her uneasy. But you are right in saying that she certainly gave the impression that she was keen to exercise full realm of prime ministerial authority. And a time when this was most dramatic was when the Argentine military junta invaded the British-owned Falkland Islands. And she, with a sort of courage of a lioness, did not hesitate in the way that many a man with military experience might have done. She didn't hesitate to immediately say, "We will fight to defend them, we will dispatch the fleet." And a great many people, starting with President Reagan and Secretary of State Al Haig, tried to dissuade her from this commitment. But she quite rightly said this was a moral outrage to have the islanders' right to self-determination suddenly conquered by military might. And so she sent off the Royal Navy with a big fleet and task force, and it recovered the islands despite the huge risks involved. She was a lucky war leader as well as a courageous one. And that rather transformed her status in Britain. People could see that she was not just a divisive political figure, but a leader of considerable courage. And it was a very, very popular war, the Falklands War, in Britain. And she won it, and that changed her status.
You touched on this in the beginning, and I just want to explore it a little bit further about her personality and how we see her as this Iron Lady, of how she was. There is that perception, but as you write, there was also this very much a willingness and looking to work and to have a battle, a discussion, a thorough argument to further understand a situation and to ultimately come to a resolution.
That's right. She wasn't the kind of leader who liked, as I think perhaps President Obama likes, to reach a kind of consensus with tremendous discussion from all parties and all angles. She had a view right from the beginning what ought to be done. And she would like to test that idea, that view, almost to destruction in argument, which is not the usual way of politicians, and certainly not the usual way of British politicians, who like to chew things over and give and take and debate and make a concession here, a concession there. That wasn't her style at all. She went in with all guns firing, and she had to be completely convinced before she stopped firing those guns and changed course. And that very strident form of argument shocked quite a few people, but it did have the good effect of changing a lot of preconceived notions. And she did change the British economy from being the sick man of Europe into being one of the most prosperous economies. She did change British decline into British preeminence in Europe and other parts of the world. And she also, I think, changed the course of history by playing a key role in thawing out the Cold War by her early relationship with Gorbachev. And I think Reagan used to say that Margaret Thatcher softened him up. Well, she certainly changed Gorbachev's mind, and I think also, to some extent, changed Reagan's mind about Gorbachev. And so she brokered some of the big changes that went on in Western and Soviet relationships during the 1980s.
When you write about her and you talk about this, is that there was such ambition, and you look a little bit as to what the source of that ambition was. And what do you think was driving her so much, especially in those early days of her career, but even to the into the bitter end of the coup inside the Conservative Party that ultimately brought her downfall?
Well, I think there are two separate issues here. When she was on the rise, her ambition was nobly patriotic. She hated Britain's decline. She hated the mess that she had inherited of a country really ruined by militant blue-collar unionism, by a general acceptance that Britain should decline economically and in its foreign policy attitudes too. She was part of the World War II generation. She'd grown up as a teenager when the Anglo-American alliance was at its height. She loved those days when Churchill and Roosevelt had really sort of run the world effectively in the Second World War. And she always wanted to get back to some of Britain's strength and Britain's preeminence in world affairs. So what was driving her was the ambition to end downward spiral of decline of Britain. Once she had really made the big changes, particularly on the economy, she'd rolled back the frontiers of a socialized state. She'd privatized great swathes of industry, which were under state control. She'd given the British a new confidence. A certain hubris entered the equation. And the hubris consisted, above all, of not being willing to listen to anyone, particularly her fellow politicians, who were, at the end of the day, her support base. And she got into a mess on several issues. But the biggest one, which no one in America will ever heard of, was called the poll tax, which was a form of local taxation, which was wildly unpopular. But she was convinced it was right, and it would have been so easy for her to change course or adjust, but she just wouldn't do it. And I think people became, in her own party particularly, felt that this was, they were no longer being led by a prime minister who was listening to them. She was being led by some sort of empress who was on the crest of a wave all the time and just simply wasn't listening to the democratic process. And that's what brought her down.
And which brings us to that question of legacy, because as you seem to point out in the book, that's still up for debate. That's still maturing. It's still being discussed and vigorously debated of what her legacy is and was and how she will be thought of in the history of Great Britain.
Well, without doubt, Margaret Thatcher will be thought of as very important in the history of Britain because, first of all, she had this unique distinction of being our first ever woman prime minister, first woman leader of any major Western democracy. And secondly, she completely revolutionized Britain's own performance and Britain's own attitudes. And from being the really basket case of the European economies, it became the strongest of the European economies. And huge national pride and self-confidence flowed from that massive change. Where she polarized people about herself and about her legacy is that she was a leader who didn't seem to care very much about those for whom she didn't feel any empathy and those who were not sort of spear carriers and supporters in her revolution. So if you were on the margins of society, if you were receiving welfare payments, if you were vulnerable, if you were not somebody who was helping to produce economic success or the kind of thing she stood for, she sounded, I think perhaps more than she really was, she sounded as though she was dismissive of those people. In actual fact, she'd come up the hard way herself. She was from a small town in the middle of England. She was the daughter of a small shopkeeper, and there'd never been any money in her family. She'd fought her way. She was a really pretty good example, almost of a British equivalent of from log cabin to White House. And yet, when she got to the top, she sounded as though she didn't care about those living on the margins of society. And so that did create a divisive feeling. She polarizes opinion, but she polarizes people more from emotional reasons than for historical reasons. Even her worst enemies, who will criticize her sharply for some of her attitudes to the poor and others, would nevertheless say, well, she was very important. She did change things. And they would disagree whether she changed things for the better or for the worse. But she certainly turned Britain in a different direction. And I think the majority feel a much better direction. So she's a massive figure historically. And I hope I've captured her both historically and politically and personally as well.
When did you last see her?
Well, I last saw her about a year before she died. And not for the first time, she came to dinner in our house. And it was a little bit like welcoming a lighthouse into your home, in the sense that there were long periods of sort of darkness when she would sit at the end of the table eating her food very quietly, but not obviously being part of the conversation or the atmosphere. And then suddenly she would perk up and there'd be a great flash of light. She'd remember something for the past, or in some way she would illuminate a bit of the conversation, and she would suddenly come alive with a great flash. And that was rather exciting, but you had to feel sorry for her during her declining years, which were plagued by ill health and minor strokes. But she was a very gutsy, courageous lady, and she still liked to come out to dinner and to dress well and to enjoy an evening. So the twilight was brave, although it was a little bit sad as well.
The title of the book is Margaret Thatcher, Power and Personality. It is published by Bloomsbury. Jonathan Aitken, thank you very much for spending time with us. I do appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on your program.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Margaret Thatcher, Power and Personality by Jonathan Aitken, published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.